Welcome back to the latest edition of the Audible presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleague Stuart Mandel. And Stu, we've already had one conference media days down, the Big 12 last week. I was with some of our colleagues in Dallas. I am headed to Indianapolis for Big 10 media days. There's a bunch of stuff going on this week, Stu. SEC kicked off its media days on Monday. I know you were glued to your TV. What did you learn?
First of all, can I just say, I don't want to sound like a complainer, but I have enjoyed watching it from afar on TV more than I've ever enjoyed attending SEC media days. I think...
Can I take a little umbrage at this? Because not to speak for Andy Staples, but I will... I can remember many times me, you, and Andy would be in that food court on the lower level at the Winfrey and enjoying everybody's company, and you don't miss us?
I love the camaraderie. I love the people, but like, it's funny, that food court is so etched in my brain. And, you know, a lot of, since there wasn't an SEC Media Days last year, a lot of people that are there have been talking about how much they missed it on Twitter. And that's one of the things that some people said they missed, the food. Seth Emerson, our Georgia writer, said he missed the food court. I don't think of the food court. I don't have like positive association. The food court usually meant, first of all, you'd be in a hurry, right? You're in between interviews. You got to get something real fast. And it's not like we're talking about the world's greatest food options at the Galleria Mall food court. But you know, the most fun part of SEC Media Days is seeing your friends and colleagues who you haven't seen in a while. And in particular, and if I were there this year, a lot of those people, obviously we haven't seen since 2019, but I do not miss sitting in that big ballroom for hours and hours and hours at a time. So the good thing about watching on TV is, you know, you see the coach, you see, I watched a lot of the coaches on Monday, and then you can turn your attention to something else in between appearances.
Did you, for old time's sake, did you do a Facebook Live from somewhere where some older people were looking at you and you had to stick out your arm as far as you could? And
oh man,
for
so many different
people who watched that.
So many different eras, right? So many different employers that I've been, I guess I've been there on behalf of three different employers. So Ed Orgeron was one of the coaches on Monday, and listening to him, it kind of made me realize how I just have no idea what to expect from LSU this season. I think in the immediate aftermath of that debacle of a season last year, my thought was they did kind of get it together at the end. Big win at Florida, outlasted Ole Miss. We knew they were going to struggle last year to some extent, given they'd lost pretty much their entire team, entire 2019 national title team. And we know there's a lot of talent there. So, you know, you look at this year's team, now it goes from being one of the least experienced to one of the most experienced teams in the SEC. Okay. Yeah. I like what I think this could be a team that gets back into contention. And then you hear Orgeron talk about how, and to his credit, he has not hid from this, that, you know, he didn't even bother to interview Bo Pelini before hiring him last year. He regrets that. Although he did say he thinks if he had interviewed him, he still would have hired him, and it just didn't work out. I feel like, and there was, you know, there was locker room dysfunction. There was a lot going on behind the scenes at LSU last year, and it hasn't stopped this offseason. In fact, he's now a defendant in a Title IX lawsuit. He refused to comment on that Monday. So it just, everything about the LSU program feels very chaotic these days. And because of that, I don't know if I can fully buy in. Is the program stable enough to have a really good season?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, we'll find out. I think the thing is, it's LSU. I feel like it's always had a measure of chaos around it. Even when Les Miles was winning, there was a measure of chaos. I mean, if you look back to when it was, even the year Orgeron took over, it was chaos. The next year, they lose to Troy. They got blown out by Mississippi State. They struggle with Syracuse. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that, you know, I covered and flipped the script of just what was a chaotic year that year. And then I even think, remember, in 2018, there was a lot of chaos behind the scenes of, a, you know, they had a bunch of a bunch of team meetings before the season, which was more than you would normally have. So I don't know, like, I don't know if I would read that much into some of that. I mean, the Bo Pelini era was as short-lived as it was. To me, that was the thing. Like, obviously, we knew they were going to lose a ton of players. That was the most surprising aspect of it. I'm not shocked that he didn't have a formal interview with Bo Pelini, to be honest. I mean, Bo Pelini is a protege of Pete Carroll, as is Ogeron. They know a lot of the same people. Bo Pelini is not a first-time defensive coordinator, and he had a lot of success at LSU when he was a defensive coordinator. And so I think the thing that was surprising was how disastrous a season it was on defense, given they have a lot of talent, at least in the secondary, but they never really were able to grasp the system. There was a lot of, it was a lack of communication back there. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to ask you, as I watch you thumb through a preseason magazine, what do you expect from them? If I set the over under on them as 8.5, you know what their schedule is like, I assume, because I think you're looking at it. What are you thinking?
I would take the over on that. I think 9-3 is a perfectly attainable thing for them, but of course that's not really what I'm not sure LSU fans would be happy with 9-3, especially after he raised the bar in 2019. They want to contend for SEC and national championships. And I don't know that I'm ready to go quite back there yet. Do you think that, so he has said that this isn't a new thing, but he said it again in Hoover, that he wants to try to get back to the kind of offense they were running in 2019 with Joe Burrow. How realistic is that? How much of that was scheme and how much of it was having Joe Burrow, who I don't think either of their current quarterback contenders is going to replicate?
I think it was a lot of factors. It wasn't just Joe Brady. It was the collection of receivers. I mean, they have one great receiver right now in Keyshawn Boutte, who was arguably All-American caliber by the end of last season. Max Johnson, I think, is one to keep an eye on because he played so well, especially at Florida. Now, obviously, Florida didn't have a great defense last year, but that was a depleted LSU team that went in there and beat the Gators. So I don't think that was an insignificant thing for him to go into a hostile environment and play as well as he did as a true freshman. I think what now you'll see, both Jake Peets, who's the play caller, and DJ Mangus, who came with him from the Panthers. And by the way, DJ Mangus was really Joe Brady's right-hand man when he was assisted in game planning and had a big role in play calling in 2019. But I think so much of it was Joe Burrow. I mean, he had a year before to acclimate to the team. I think what they wanted to do going empty, I think that fits him really well. He's as close to a coach on the field as any quarterback I've seen in college football since I've covered it in 20 plus years. And whether it's Max Johnson, who's going to be a true sophomore, or Miles Brennan, who hasn't played that many games, I don't think that's as realistic. But we're also talking about what was the most explosive offense in the history of college football. I mean, to expect it, I don't see anybody doing that. But if they get to be very good, much less, I mean, that was arguably the greatest offense we've ever seen in college football. So I think that's not a realistic goal. I mean, I think they can, I'm not saying they will be a playoff team, but they could be a playoff team without having as great an offense as that was. If they are, I mean, that was a 10 out of 10. I'd say, you know, remember, before this run at LSU, typically the offense was like a 6. And it was a 6 because they had elite running backs. It wasn't because their passing game was that explosive. So I think if you get, you know, back somewhere above that, if you're a 7 or an 8, I think they can be really good, because I think their defense, you know, they have the best cornerback tandem in the country. They're deep in the secondary. They have a lot of players up front who are talented. I think that's a team that should be much, much improved on defense, just if they're all on the same page now.
Yeah, it's crazy to look at, you know, 124th in the country in defense last season. And then you look at the depth chart and you think, how is that possible when you've got Stingley, Eli Ricks, who's also a very highly ranked, regarded cornerback, guys like Glenn Logan, Neil Farrell, who've been on that defensive line, Ali Gay. Like, I feel like those guys have been playing on their defensive line forever. I did have a coach tell me recently that, you know, I think there was a perception last year when everything shut down and these teams that had coaching changes and didn't have spring practice, that it made it a lot harder to install a new offense. He says the opposite. It was harder for defenses, new coaches to install a defense, and it really showed with some teams. And for whatever reason, the Bo Pelini thing didn't work out, but I wonder how much of it was he had an inexperienced defense to begin with, and it just turned out to be the wrong year to try to shift your defense from a 3-4 to a 4-3 and everything that goes with it. So I don't think this year's change will be quite as drastic. And so much of what went wrong last year was just miscommunication, guys in, out of position, including Stingley, who we know is good. So yeah, they should be a lot better. I'll say this much, first game of the season at UCLA, everybody is intrigued by that. But honestly, LSU should win that game. They should win that game handily. They're much more talented than UCLA. If they don't, if they lose, or if it's, you know, they really struggle in that game, that to me doesn't bode well for their chances in the SEC.
It doesn't, but keep in mind this. You talked about how experienced LSU is. UCLA is actually more experienced than LSU is, this team, considering they have almost everybody back, and they have a quarterback in Dorian Thompson-Robinson who has now played a ton of football. It's also not going to be their first game because they're going to play Hawaii the week before. I think this sets up pretty well for Chip Kelly's team there to pull an upset. So not to hype the game too much on Fox, but Stu, you should come down and go to the Rose Bowl. I know
they can pull the upset, but if they do, I think it's going to be, I think that'll be the moment when all of the goodwill from the 2019 team officially for Coach O, officially the last vestiges of it wear off and everybody's pissed off at him all over again.
Yes, because I don't think people look at this UCLA team or even Chip Kelly as this is an Oregon's Chip Kelly who,
no,
you know, played less miles, whatever it was, a dozen years ago. I think that game was in Dallas. But this is a, you know, much different. But look, this, that's one of the most compelling matchups of that first big weekend of college football. Okay, so what else are we focusing in on or this week? Because obviously SEC Media Days is still playing out. I'm curious as to, I know you were riveted to Greg Sankey's speech at the beginning of, mm-hmm. of this to kick it off. Our friend Ross Dellinger from SI had a very extensive kind of advance of it where he was talking about kind of the environment right now in the around college athletics with the NCAA and Mark Emmert really kind of reeling from just what has been a disastrous kind of series of events that have fallen that way. And now conference bigwigs such as Greg Sankey are speaking out. What did you take away from his comments beyond Ross's story, I would say?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a column about that and just sort of the climate around the NCAA, and I would encourage people to go to The Athletic and read that and use theathletic.com/audible to get a discount on your subscription. You know, in terms of, I thought what was more notable in terms of maybe something more tangible for the season is that he was asked right off the bat, you know, in terms of, I mean, first of all, in his comments, he made a point of very bluntly saying that none of the teams need to get vaccinated. Only six of them, he said, are at the 80% mark. And so he was asked flat out if a team, you know, last year, if a team had COVID issues, the game would be declared a no contest and rescheduled if it could. He made it very clear, like, that's not an option this year. They didn't build extra weeks into the schedule. Games are not going to be rescheduled. So he was asked, if a team can't make it, is that team going to have to forfeit? And he didn't go all the way on that, but he strongly hinted that that's ultimately the policy that they're going to come up with. And so you tell me, it seems to me, if you need an incentive, if the coach needs an incentive to encourage his players to get vaccinated, going out there and saying like, hey, if we get too many of these cases, we will get a loss, not a reschedule, a loss, should be a pretty strong motivator.
Yeah, and I think that's something you were going to hear. I mean, we heard it as we're taping this today on Tuesday from the MAC commissioner as well, forfeit. And I think you will hear that a lot more around the sport. And again, this is something that has come up a lot in some of these coaches' availabilities now. I think Dabo Swinney also spoke about it, as our colleague Grace Rayner had reported. So I think this is just a reality of college athletics in 2021, especially with, you know, where things are now with the pandemic. As much as it feels like we're getting back to normal, I think this is part of our, this will be part of our normal, at least for the relative, hopefully, short term.
Well, you know, I was kind of hoping that the new normal would be that we never have to worry about games getting canceled, but we are seeing, like, Team USA had a game canceled. So I hope people don't, you know, teams don't go into this naively thinking that they're incapable of having a disruption like that. Hopefully there'll be a lot fewer, but right now, if you're a betting man, yeah, I do think some games will be affected unless teams get that vaccination rate up to the, I believe the reason 85%, right, keeps getting thrown around is that that's what the NFL is using, that once you get to 85%, you don't have to get tested every day. They're not going to contact trace the way they normally would. So the more teams that get to that, to get to that threshold, the more this will feel like a completely normal season.
All right, so I want to stick in while we're in the SEC, two programs that I don't think either one of us or anybody else is talking about as potential playoff teams, but they're both intriguing because they have second-year coaches, and they're second-year coaches with big profiles and honestly big social media followings, and that is Mike Leach's Mississippi State program, which I think for a minute ESPN's like FBI or FPI or whatever that metric they have is, had them as like a top 10 team, and then I think they had to revise it where they're like, wait a minute, this really looks stupid, we need to fix our math. And then there is Lane Kiffin, a little north of him in Oxford, in his second year. So those guys will always get attention for what they say and how they say it. Realistically, do you feel like they will become nationally relevant this year? Not for what their teams do on the field. And I'm not saying just for, they're always relevant in terms of social media presence, but for what they do on the field. Mike Leach had some really good teams at Washington State. Lane Kiffin had a couple of good teams at FAU, but obviously now they're in, as one coach had put it when Leach got there, the deep end of the pool. So it's year two. Give me your feeling on where these are headed.
I have more confidence in Ole Miss than I do Mississippi State, because frankly, they were pretty good last year. They went, the final record says 5-5, but that included taking national champion Alabama to the wire in a 63-48 shootout. They beat Indiana, who was a top 10 Indiana team, in the bowl game, and they did it with an absolutely atrocious defense. So defense can't be worse. You got to think it's going to get at least a little bit better. And I've been interested in the way they've got a lot of weapons on offense, but, you know, obviously Matt Corral, the quarterback, is the headliner. And I've been interested in how I feel like when those initial, like right after the draft, early mock drafts came out, he was not among the Spencer Rattler, group of quarterbacks who were being mentioned as, but now he is. Now he's suddenly being mentioned as one of the three or four possibly highest ranked quarterbacks in the draft. I did Ole Miss's State of the Program, so I know that team pretty cold at this point. And I know that Lane Kiffin feels that he's a pretty special quarterback and that he has a chance to do you know, he wants to take advantage of that. You remember he fired the offensive line coach right after spring practice, which raised a lot of eyebrows. But I think he felt like he can't afford to wait any longer for that offensive line to get better because he doesn't want to waste this opportunity.
Are you buying that the defense, which was horrific, is going to get a lot better so they could possibly be? Because you had them around your top 25 at one point now in your preseason top 25.
I think they can get to be like a middle of the pack defense. They're not going to be elite by any.
That is a huge step from where they were. Middle of the pack is a huge step. I mean, they were
one of the worst in all of FBS.
Yeah.
They got some first of all, Otis Reese transferred from Georgia and got eligible right before the Egg Bowl last year. And it had an effect. He was immediately one of the best players on their defense. You know, you see what they did in the bowl game against Indiana with him. And then they've got a bunch of other transfers who they expect to. They got some JUCO guys on the defensive line. They've got a safety actually from Navy who they think will start. Now they did, weirdly, Jacquez Jones, who was kind of he's a leading tackler the last 2 years. And he was kind of like the face of the defense. He was the spokesman a lot in the spring. And then all of a sudden he transferred. He's at Kentucky now. So the transfer portal giveth and the transfer portal taketh away.
Realistically,
they're still going to have to win a lot of shootouts.
What should help them is that they're going to play four non-conference opponents. And so that will figures to help kind of light, you know, you should pad some stats certainly against Austin Peay. I don't know how much you will against
Louisville. Isn't that true of the whole conference though?
It is. You know what's an interesting game to me, and I didn't realize that it was happening, which I'm sure you knew because you did your schedule analysis for State of the Program. Hugh Freeze is coming home to Oxford.
I know. How about that?
And he's bringing a quarterback. You talked about Matt Corral. I mean, Malik Willis is really talented, and he's really dangerous in that system. And that game sits in between a road trip to Auburn and against Texas A&M. So it's not exactly the cupcake you want. But
yeah, I mean, that game is on November 6th, which tells me it was scheduled as the November. They're not FCS, obviously, but you know, November FCS type sleeper. And it actually could be a great game. Liberty finished the season in the top 25 last year. So, you know, they've got Louisville that Monday night. I think that that's a game that you would favor Ole Miss just because Louisville was pretty bad last year. But I have by no means given up on Scott Satterfield, who I think is a really good coach. And
what is
considerably better.
What is good for Lane, I think, is that if you look at the crossover games for the East, they play Vandy at home. Vandy is terrible. They play Tennessee. Obviously, there's a big game for Lane just because of his history there, but it's not like we expect Tennessee to be very good. So, you know, when you're taking two of the weaker teams from the East, that's okay, right? So
I think that between LSU, A&M, and Ole Miss, none of them are going to, well, I shouldn't say that. I don't think Ole Miss is going to win the division.
I don't think they are either.
No, I don't think Ole Miss is going to win the division, but I could see them finishing anywhere from second to fourth in the SEC West, depending on, like we just talked about LSU. LSU could be all over the map. Everybody's very high on A&M, but it's not inconceivable that they take a little bit of a step back. So now Mississippi State is not a team I consider to be in that tier, but maybe you do. Sell me on the Bulldogs.
I can't sell you much beyond this. It is Leach's first full, you know, offseason there. And I think his system does take some time to rep and develop. And whether it's Will Rogers or Jack Abraham was a really productive quarterback at Southern Miss who transferred there. I think he has two good options. We talked about this a while back, and I mean, I'm talking like pre-pandemic about how Leach would do in the SEC West. They do have some good parts on defense, and he does tend to surprise people. Like usually when people write him off is when he's at his most dangerous. I don't know. I'm with you. Like I wouldn't go as far. I don't see Ole Miss, you know, this year being as good as you indicate they might be. And I definitely, I'm probably more with you on Mississippi State right now. I think they'll be better. I just don't know how much better, and it's in that division, so it's going to be tough sledding. You know, the team that one of the teams that I'm really intrigued by, just before we jump off the SEC, is on the other side, and that's Kentucky. You mentioned them in passing, where they got, you know, the best player on the Ole Miss defense, who was a really productive linebacker. I feel like they've made some really nice additions. We talked about LSU. They got Dare Rosenthal, who's has top 50 draft pick talent as a left tackle. I think he will help. Will Levis, who is from Penn State, has a ton of arm talent, is very athletic, and I think he can help them. And we're talking about new play callers. And I think Liam Cohen, who came from the Rams, where he was an offensive assistant, I think he has a chance to do some interesting things, because they don't have great skill talent, but Wandell Robinson, and we'll talk about Nebraska in a bit, is very dynamic, and I think he will help them. And I think Mark Stoops, to get to the, you know, kind of hammer home the point, I think Mark Stoops is the most underrated coach in the SEC. And I am I'm curious to see what they do now, because I think now people know there's nothing fluky about how they kind of bounced up a couple of years ago. I think this is a really good program, and they've done a really good job developing talent.
Yeah, they've no doubt cleaned up with the transfer portal. That could end up having a big impact on their season. They're also a team that, you know, you mentioned it with Ole Miss, you know, because these teams played only SEC teams last year, a lot of them had, you know, disappointing records, and Kentucky was one of those. They went 4-6 and then beat NC State in the bowl game to finish 5-6. Well, now they go back to a typical, more typical Kentucky schedule that includes Louisiana Monroe, Chattanooga, New Mexico State. Good job finding that one. And then at Louisville, you could see Kentucky, they don't even have to get drastically better, just get a little bit better and be 8-4 or maybe even 9-3, and everybody's happy again.
Could they? Like, I think Emory Jones is going to be very good, so I don't want to say could they end up being the second best team in the East.
But I think they could end up being the second best team in the East, because Florida has a lot of questions. Now, Florida has been a thorn in Kentucky's side for like 30 years. They've lost some games to them they shouldn't have. But I think you know, probably come down to, is Will Levis or whoever wins that job, like they've had too many years now of these one-dimensional offenses that can't, they barely even try to throw the ball. You know, they need a more balanced offense, and hopefully having a guy like Wandell Robinson incentivizes that. Like, they've actually got some guys that can beat you on the outside now.
All right. So while we're talking about Wandell Robinson, I think this is a great segue, Stu.
Sure is. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah. So I didn't sell Kentucky to go for this, but I'm excited to go to Indianapolis this year. It's not in Chicago. Big Ten Media Days will be there. So before we kind of dig too deep into the Big Ten, the Nebraska Cornhuskers are fascinating for all sorts of reasons, but I'm going to start with this. After we taped the podcast the other day, there was some news out of Lincoln, where one of your old, and this is fair to say, this was somebody you mentored earlier in their...
I wouldn't say mentored.
Oh, I would. You mentored former Nebraska great Trev Alberts, who was in the news recently. How come you did not have the scoop that he was going to be the new AD?
Okay, so my backstory with Trev Alberts is this. My first job in this industry was at CNNSI in Atlanta. For people too young to remember that existed, the site that ended up becoming SI.com started out as a joint venture between CNN and Sports Illustrated, and believe it or not, they had a TV network, a 24-hour... sports news network, much like ESPN News.
Not to give our friend Richard Deitch some story ideas, somebody should do the oral history on CNNSI. Not only was Stu Mandel's career launched by CNNSI, wasn't Stephen A. Smith and also?
Oh, there was a bunch. First of all, that was Tom Rinaldi was there. Laura Oakman was there. But yes, Stephen A. Smith, original, his first foray into, he was a Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper writer. His first foray into television was as CNSI's one of their, I guess, NBA experts. So, I mean, now I wish we hadn't given this away on the podcast. Somebody else might try to beat Deitch to it, but I agree that'd be a fascinating story.
Who else was
So that,
who else had the roots in the CNSI tree there? I mean, Tom Rinaldi's a heavyweight name. Between Tom Rinaldi, Stephen A. Smith, and you, that's got to be like $15 million worth of contracts.
to be clear, I was not a part of the TV network. So here was, I mean, I guess it launched Trev Alberts, right? Here we're talking, he's now the Nebraska AD. But so he was he lived in Atlanta. He was the college football analyst for that TV network. And every week, my job as a 22, 23-year-old bottom of the food chain guy was to go over and sit down with him, and we would pick two or three topics. And I would basically interview him about it. This is called ghostwriting, right? This is how you've done a lot of ghostwriting in your years. You interview them, and then you turn that into a column that appears to have been written by him. And we did that for, I want to say, two or three seasons. And then he moved on to ESPN. I liked working with Trev. He was perfectly great with me, but I would say that it was pretty evident then that the man had a pretty big ego. And then he goes to ESPN, and I'm amazed this has not come up in the coverage of the hire last week. I have not seen it mentioned at all. Trev Alberts' ESPN tenure ended quite dramatically. You remember this, you were at ESPN. So basically, he and Mark May were, I want to say, like the guys who were in studio all day,
That
right?
was
They
quite a
weren't,
tag team for ESPN at that
yeah,
point.
really. They weren't on game day, but I want to say they would like throw to them sometimes during game day, but they were back in Bristol. And one day Trev got sick of being second fiddle to game day and just walked off the set and was never seen again. So that was the end of his, well, he may have resurfaced on CBS for a little bit, but the point is his TV days are long past. He became the AD at UNO, Nebraska Omaha, 12 years ago. And by all accounts, did a fantastic job there. Helped them move up to Division One, made a controversial decision to drop the football program, but that paid off. That, it was such a big money loser. And then they were able to move up to D1. He got a hockey arena built. So I saw a lot of snickering when the hire was announced, is like, oh, Nebraska, look at them. We can't get past the 90s. Like there was an insinuation there that he was unqualified. I mean, he's a D1 AD for 12 years. This isn't USC hiring Lynn Swann out of the blue and you like almost pulling over, driving off the road when I told you that. He's highly qualified to be the AD. The question is, I mean, the single biggest question is, what does this mean for Scott Frost? Because Bill Moose was such an unabashed supporter of Scott Frost. He hired him. He was going to give him the longest leash possible. We have no idea how Trev Alberts is going to react if Scott Frost has another disappointing season.
Yeah, I'm curious about that myself, just because, look, I feel like we've talked about this before, and I'm sure we're going to talk about it again, not too distant future. But like, so far, I have been very wrong in my prediction of what I thought was going to happen with Nebraska football. Scott Frost is 12-20. He has never had he's never won more than three games in Big Ten play. 3-6, 3-6, 3-5. You were probably not quite as effusive in the hire as I was, but I think it's
No, I
fair.
was pretty darn effusive.
Okay, so look, are you completely off the bandwagon for Scott Frost? Are you thinking, all right, he's not going to get it? I think there's two choices here, three choices. Are you completely off the bandwagon? You don't think he's going to get it done? You don't have as lofty of expectations, but you think the hire will get better? Or do you think, okay, it's 2021, this is going to be the year I'm putting my chips down on the table, now I'm going to be proven right?
I don't think I'm going to get proven right in turn, because I think I said he would have won a Big Ten title by now. So I don't think I'm going to get proven right
Okay.
like that. It has been surprising. You knew there was going to be a bit of rebuilding involved. I think but I would have expected certainly, I mean, the real puzzler is he was the offensive coordinator of those great Oregon teams, some of those great Oregon teams. He was the head coach of a UCF team that went undefeated and had a great offense, and just has not been able to remotely replicate that in Lincoln. And I do look back at that season when it was apparent that he was going to be, you know, the hot candidate that year. Like, I, for most of that part, thought he would, I assumed he would choose Florida over Nebraska for that reason. Like, Florida is full of great athletes, speed, you know, the guys you need to have the kind of Oregon UCF blur offense. It's a lot harder to recruit those guys to Nebraska. But, you know, I underestimated his loyalty to his home state and his alma mater, and that's fine. But I think he's learning the hard way that it's a lot harder than he thought it would be to get those kind of guys. And on top of that, compounding that, the few guys he has gotten have transferred. And I think that's where you really question him, because he needed to improve the recruiting. To some extent he did, but then for whatever reason, he's not holding on to those guys. And Wandale Robinson obviously is the leading example of that. He was his biggest name playmaker. And now he's gone. Maurice Washington was supposed to be a great running back. He got into off the field issues. Luke McCaffrey was going to be the next thing at quarterback. He's gone. So I think if you have some patience, he would eventually build this thing up. I just don't know. Like, he can't have another losing season. I don't know how you continue to stand by a guy who 4 years later has yet to have a winning record. But if he can get them to a bowl game, which, by the way, they haven't done since 2015 or 2016. Then would Trev Alberts be willing to give it another go, especially given he has an absolutely insane buyout? I want to say like a $25 million buyout.
Yeah. You put out a lot of things there that I agree with. I mean, looking at their schedule, you know, it doesn't help that you have Oklahoma in that old rivalry game sitting there in week four, but they should. So we talked a little bit ago about LSU UCLA game. This is a week zero game the week before, August 28th, Nebraska at Illinois, Brett Bielema's first game, right?
A highlight of week zero.
It is the game of week zero, right?
Yeah.
So that game is sitting there. If you're Nebraska and you lose that road game, here's, you know, Brett Bielema's first game.
That would
game,
be bad news.
It would. Now, by the way, Illinois has a lot of players back. Like, the team that you went to the game, I remember it was the game, our bowl game. It was Illinois-Cal.
I watched that from the comfort of my home.
Okay. Well, at least you watched. But anyway, that Illinois team, pretty much everybody was going to be back. Like, it was a pretty... It was a decent team. It's not like Illinois is an atrocious team right now. And I think Bielema, you and I both agree, knows what he's doing and is a good fit in the Big Ten. And it's a home game. So, tricky opener. Then they.
By the way, Nebraska lost to Illinois last year, 41-23. To an Illinois team that fired its coach.
So, you have at Illinois, then you have Fordham, then you have a good Buffalo team, albeit without Jarrett Patterson and without Lance Leipold, but those are both home games. You got to win both of those games.
I want the backstory of how Fordham ended up coming to Nebraska.
Do you really?
Yeah, of all the FCS schools you could schedule, why is it Fordham?
I don't know. Maybe there was some kind of Joe Moorhead affinity that they had. Or maybe they were trying to please your friend Ralph Russo and get him to come to the Midwest.
Well, whatever the case, I'm fired up for that September 4th showdown.
But like I said, it is, you got to get out of the gate 3-0 if you're talking about what you're talking about. Because if you don't, like I said, you go to Illinois, then you have at Michigan State, and then it's not going to be very easy. Because, by the way, the Big Ten West team, this is who they have to play from the other side. They have to go to Michigan State. Okay, that's, you know, if you're going to be a really good team, you should
winnable
game. at, you know, versus Michigan, then you have to go to Ohio State. Not easy, right? There's no, you know, it's Ohio State's as bad as you can, you know, have to have on your schedule, right? So, and you're finishing after Ohio State at Wisconsin and then against Iowa. That is a rough last three games for Scott Frost.
I think the two things Nebraska, I think, has going for it. One, you have a fourth year starting quarterback now in Adrian Martinez. I know he has never quite lived up to what they thought he would do after his first season. He did complete 71.5% of his passes last year. He also got benched at one point last year. So it's been a mixed bag, but maybe it kind of comes together for one last big season. And then they actually could be pretty good on defense. The offense still is a huge question mark, but defense, Cam Taylor Britt's a really good cornerback. JoJo Doman's a really good linebacker. There's just a lot of experience across the board there. So if I had to guess, I think Nebraska will improve and go to a bowl game this year, and that should take a little bit of the heat off Frost. But like I said, I mean, if it's a 4-8 kind of year, I don't see how you go on. And it's just kind of at that point, you got, you know, I think Nebraska fans would be like, I mean, it's, we kind of talk about this sometimes in Michigan and Harbaugh, like, if not this guy, who? This guy, if you were to build on paper the profile of the perfect Nebraska coach as of 3 years ago, it would have been Scott Frost. So Mike Riley was a disaster. Bo Pelini, I think, is now like getting some revisionist, hey, maybe we shouldn't have taken this guy for granted, but was still losing four games a year.
But they were consistently good. It was just the off-field issues, and you know,
played in Big Ten title games, but they also had a lot of embarrassing losses. And hey, if you're Nebraska, you think you should be able to do more than go 9-4 every year. Problem is, the guys since him have done even worse.
Yeah, I don't know. And also, there were issues. The off-field. I don't even say it was his persona. It was on field. It was on field.
It was his sideline meltdowns and I would say also a secretly leaked audio tape of him cursing out his own fan base. So
yes, if you ever want an entertaining read and you haven't read it yet, go Google Mitch Sherman's opus on that. It's honestly one of the more entertaining things that we've ever put out on The Athletic, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think we should get to some mailbag questions.
Okay, as always, you can send your questions to theaudiblepod@gmail.com.
Our first question is from Eddie, who says, "Hi, Stu and Bruce. Hope you guys are well. Love the pod. I read Kane Mutiny relatively recently after Miami was ranked as high as number 3 in the AP Top 25 a few years ago. Kane Mutiny is how old, Bruce? 16 or so years?
Ooh, it is more than that. It is coming up on, it's like 18 years old.
I still remember reading the galley of it. It was the first time I'd ever had access to the galleys of a book. It was fascinating. He says, it seemed for sure Miami was back to being a perennial top 5 team every year, but have since fallen back to earth. Manny Diaz has recruited well and continues to add some nice talent via the transfer portal. Do you think that Miami is in the best position to challenge Clemson going forward out of all the other ACC teams? But if not, who do you think is best positioned to do so and why? And he uses UNC and Florida State as the examples.
I do think Miami is now in the best position to challenge them. I think that Manny Diaz has put together a really good staff. I think his Rhett Lashley hire was excellent. I think they're much better on that side of the ball than they have been in a long, long time. You don't get your offensive line fixed overnight, but I think they've taken big steps on that front. I mean, to me, the two programs that would be in consideration for that right now, because, and you and I talked about this like a couple of weeks ago, FSU fell so fast and so far, you know, towards the end of Jimbo, and then it just, the bottom dropped out in the last year or two. But North Carolina is really good. I still think that Miami has a chance at least to be a consistent top 10 team because of the way they're now recruiting. And I think because of the base that Diaz has been very smart about, as Eddie says, about the talent they brought in the transfer portal. You know, it's not just De'Arik King. It's a lot of guys to upgrade the offense. They've had some first-round picks leave, and I feel like it's now they're in position to kind of to keep it going. I don't think they're like it, this is, you know, we talked about this before. It's not like it is Miami back question. It's going to be a ways before we can really get even to broach that. But I think last year they showed some signs and they played Clemson and Clemson outclassed them and they got blown out of the building. I think the question for them in this opener, with especially against Alabama, is can they be competitive for four quarters? It's not just a matter of, hey, they had a drive and they had a big play and now it's 17-7 and then next thing you know it's 31-10. I think it's like, can they be competitive? And that doesn't mean it comes down to the last play necessarily. It's like, can it be, you know, 38-28 or something where it's like you're in the game in the fourth quarter and you have a chance? And I think if they can get to that, then I think we can start to talk about where Miami's headed from there.
I think Miami is the clear second best team in the going into the season in the ACC. Some people might say UNC. UNC lost a ton on offense. Of course, they do still have Sam Howell. But if nothing else, I feel like Miami needs to take advantage of this window in time where, I mean, I know a lot of people got a really bad first impression of Manny Diaz because that first season they had some awful losses, including that bowl game to Louisiana Tech. But, you know, Mark Richt kind of left a mess at the quarterback position. So you have this one more year with De'Aaron King, high-level quarterback. I know he's going to be coming off a major injury, but, you know, certainly expected to play at a very high level. And, you know, Florida State is not close to being back yet. They may well get there, but they're not there yet. I think UNC has a chance to be a really good program. They're not quite there yet. This has kind of got to be the year. If you're going to threaten Clemson, this probably needs to be it. So, you know, are they the best chance to dismantle Clemson, to take down Clemson? Probably, but that window could close pretty quickly.
Next question is an interesting one from Eric Collins in Mesa, Arizona. Gentlemen, if you were new Pac-12 Commissioner George Kliavkov, would you rather see an embattled Arizona State team go undefeated and finally return the Pac-12 playoff, to the playoff, or see a two-loss Oregon Duck squad on the outside looking in? Please forgive me wanting nice things for my bumbling program. Love your guys' work. Go Suns!
Gosh, I hope that Go Suns part is still relevant by the time people listen to this episode.
You're rooting against the Bucks to close it out tonight?
I'd love to just see it get to a game seven. I don't have a preference of who wins, but it would be really cool to see a game seven. I know why he's asking that. Like, would you want to have the scandal torn team be the face of your conference? But absolutely, they need to get a team in the playoff. They need to end that perception. And so if it's Arizona State, it's Arizona State. It would be weird to have a head coach who's under NCAA scrutiny. But you know what? I feel like that happens in college basketball all of the time. Like UConn won the national title and the next year they were banned. And this is going way back, but Kansas, Larry Brown, like the next year that happens, right? So you get the glory and then you deal with the repercussions later. I think, the drought of not going to, we're going on 5 years now of not having a Pac-12 team in the playoff. And it has just been so damaging to their brand. They really need it to end as soon as possible and not wait around for, oh, soon there'll be an expanded playoff and they'll probably have a conference. No, you need it to end now and stop these great West Coast quarterbacks from constantly. Just this past week, right? Another Southern Cal quarterback, Malachi Nelson, picking Oklahoma over USC. Like they got to stem it. And you know, maybe Arizona State wouldn't, you know, obviously I think if you had your druthers as the Pac-12 commissioner, I know you're supposed to be neutral, would probably do more for the conference if USC was that team. But any team would be preferable to none.
Who do you think, if not Oregon, rank the teams that you think have the best chance to make the playoff out of the Pac-12? Taking Oregon out of it.
I'd probably go Utah next.
Really? You would have Utah as the number one team outside of Oregon to make the playoff?
Well, I've already said, and I think I've said it on here, I think they're my pick to win the South. And that this was before the recruiting stuff, but I thought ASU was also ahead of USC. Who knows?
So you go Utah, ASU, USC.
Well, now I'll flip it to Utah, okay. USC, because I have questions about, like, we don't know who, you know, are some key players going to have. You know, remember the season where Miami, like the week of the first game, suddenly Ja'Cory Harris and a bunch of other guys were ineligible?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know yet, but possibly that could happen.
So. I mean, have you been paying attention to what Mark Emmert and the NCAA have been saying?
Yeah, leave us alone. We've got enough to deal with. But that one was offered up to them on a platter. I do think that even that enforcement division, which Greg Sankey took some shots at in Hoover, can figure that one out.
Stu, this next question is directly for you. It's from Blaine in Virginia. Dear Stu, you've been a recruiting rankings matter, and don't put stock in the bowl game guy. You seem to be ignoring these issues to hype ISU and claim Texas has no chance. A stat I like to evaluate teams is their record in one score games. Iowa State went 4-2 in them last year, which indicates they had a bit of good fortune and weren't steamrolling teams every week.
Lane is right, and I'm a little surprised he's directing this to me when you're the one who said you think they can not just get to the playoff, but win a game in the playoff, which I think is going too far. I'm going to actually address this. There's a similar question to this in my written mailbag this week, but I mean, I'm nothing but amazed at what Matt Campbell has done there. I think they're a great program now, and that they absolutely have a chance to win the Big 12 this year. But I think, you know, you were really challenging me last week in terms of like, why don't you think Iowa State will be better? They've got so many great players. They're more of don't you think they're still kind of, frankly, a little bit similar to Iowa and what the program he's built there in terms of, you know, Iowa has first round picks. Iowa has a few guys like that every year. Iowa State probably has a few of them this year.
But no, I feel
like their roster top to bottom up against.
I feel like Iowa State right now has a unique combination of really good receivers, a really experienced quarterback, big time running back, and a proven offensive line. I feel like Iowa at times had great tight ends, experienced quarterback. But they didn't have the big time running back at that point, or they didn't have the guys outside. I feel like right now Iowa State has that. They have really good receivers, great tight end, great running back, experienced quarterback, very experienced offensive line. I don't remember, it's been a long time, and I don't want to go all the way back to maybe the Brad Banks days of, you know, whatever it was, 18 years ago or 20 years ago. But I don't like and I have a lot of respect for Kirk Ferentz and what he's done there, but I don't remember that dynamic quite in play for another team like this. That's why I think they're different and why I think you're wrong.
Okay. I can accept that you're right. Iowa has not had a lot of teams where they click checked off every box. And even when they came close to that, you know, they would go and they got that Brad Banks team got blown out by USC. 2015 team got blown out by Stanford, but you know, when you say Iowa State has great receivers, let's quantify that. If they were facing Alabama or Clemson or Ohio State in a playoff game, you would not be saying that they're in the same.
Well, category. I think they have an All-American tight end. They have an All-Big 12, first-team All-Big 12 wideout, and they have an All-American running back.
They do. They definitely have the All-American running back. Purdy is a guy who is a very experienced quarterback who had earned the nickname Brocktober for those clutch wins. But I was actually kind of surprised recently when I saw where he actually ranks in pass efficiency nationally. It's actually not that great. Again, I hate to take this approach because it seems like I'm dumping all over.
It does seem like you're dumping on them.
But I will say this to Blaine's question about why I'm hyping them up and giving Texas no chance. I mean, what has Texas done in the last 10 to 12 years to make you think they do have it? It'll happen at some point, but which team do I have more confidence to have like a nationally prominent season this year? Absolutely, Iowa State. Sark would have to come in and do some things that frankly haven't been done there in a long time in his first season to give Texas that chance. I mean, sounds crazy to say it given their national prestige, if you will, but I definitely have more faith in Iowa State than Texas.
Yeah, I mean, enough said. I agree.
All right, so you're heading off to, I almost said Chicago by default. You're heading off to Indy. There's also ACC Media Days later this week. Next week, I'm going to take the short jaunt down to LA for Pac-12 Media Days, which should be interesting, with the new commissioner, George Kliavkoff, making his debut. I have a feeling he's going to make some waves just based on my initial impression of him. And I met him in Dallas and, you know, you remember his introductory Zoom call. He seems like somebody who is going to tell it like it is, even if that rocks the establishment a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see that. You're going to be there as well in LA because you live there.
Yeah.
So, wow. When's the last time we were in the same place in person?
I think it was at the NFL Combine.
Yep. 2020 NFL Combine / Athletics Summit, which
I think
fortuitously got in like 2 weeks before the world shut down.
I vaguely remember going to a well-known late night spot in Indianapolis with me where you were hanging out with Brady Quinn.
You're making that seem much more.
It's true. It happened. Did it not happen?
No, but the way you described it, you're making it sound like a more risque establishment. It was a hotel bar.
It's not. That place isn't a hotel
bar. Oh, no. That's what's it called? Prime 57 or something?
Yeah.
It was the place that everybody talks about in terms of the NFL Combine. All right. Well, we'll have to have a nice big reunion in LA next week, and we will. I'm not sure when we'll have a chance to record the podcast, but we absolutely should try to do it in person. We'll see you guys next time.